So, Sonia, before we begin this episode, I've got to say that for you and my audience, this episode will be a total black box for me. I have no idea what you're going to say. I have no foundational knowledge in anything with machine learning or artificial intelligence in the technical way we will talk about it. I think a lot of people are really stuck on seeming smart in podcasts about artificial intelligence. Something I noticed in a few I watched up until our interview is that a lot of people don't seem to know what they're talking about. I'm not going to say whose podcast, which episode, because I don't want to get in trouble, but I wrote down three sentences and I looked at it and I was like, I don't think this is English. These are all English words, but I think if we were to take all of them apart and ask the person what they meant, they would not be able to give me an answer. Before I begin everything, am I on the money? Like, do you feel that way too? Do you feel like people are just walking into conferences and giving speeches and not understanding anything, but saying it with such strong conviction that everyone else looks back and they're like, yeah, we know what you're talking about?
I love that because there's definitely a lot of that. There's a lot of hiding in jargon. Even sometimes I'm like, wait, I am just almost saying these cached buzzwords that are trending, whether it's world models or interpretability or chain of thought reasoning. But the words almost become ungrounded from what they actually mean in their actual definitions. So it's such a cliche, but it's still so true, where it's like you don't actually understand something unless you can explain it to someone who's 5, who's 10, who's 20, who's your age and a very smart person, but has no background knowledge, which is in the case we are now. And that's the most challenging one. So I'm really looking forward to this and really excited to be here. And I'm really happy that you have no background knowledge here because it'll make all of us question all our assumptions instead of just getting lost in jargon and trying to sound smart.
I took breaks in between watching and listening to podcasts and videos about physics by watching episodes of Fraggle Rock and the line where Gobo, Moki, Weebly, Momo, Red. I was like, this is just like an AI podcast. Hey everyone, I'm in the studio with Sonia Joseph, a leading, if not the leading researcher on world models and interpretability in artificial intelligence. She is getting her PhD in artificial intelligence and world models from the University of McGill in Canada. She holds an undergraduate degree in neuroscience and creative writing from Princeton. And today she is going to come on my show to explain world models and some other stuff about physics and AI. I don't know. I have some espresso with me and ice cream. Let's begin. How you doing, Sonia?
Hey, I'm great. Thank you so much for having me on your show. I'm so excited to talk to you. The stuff we're talking about is really at the cutting edge, and I can't wait to share more.
All right, let's begin. What are world models? Can you just define that for me?
A world model is when an AI system has an internal representation of the world. And here we're talking about the physical world. So, for example, if I'm to show the AI model a cup full of water or full of martini, and I'm to drop the cup, I can ask the AI model, what happens when I drop the cup? And the AI model should say, oh, the cup breaks and the espresso martini flies everywhere. And this sounds really basic, but a lot of our current AI models, like our ChatGPT models and et cetera, are really bad at this. And this is called physical reasoning or spatial reasoning. And it's just reasoning about how, like, the physical world actually works. So stuff that we might find really obvious, like, oh, if I kick the ball, it's going to go into the corner. Or stuff like object permanence, like if I hide my keys behind this cup, the keys have not disappeared. They're still there. They're behind the cup. If you ask a lot of these AI models questions that toddlers should get right, the AI models don't know. If you've tried to generate images with ChatGPT, a lot of people find that really basic requests like make the cars all drive in the same direction don't actually work, and the AI model might generate images that appear to violate common sense or physics. A lot of the research is just how do you give AI common sense about the physical world? And this is the next frontier. And it sounds so obvious, but it's actually so hard to do properly.
It sounds like you are teaching AI theory of mind.
theory of mind might be a component, but I actually think that's even more complex than what we're trying to do, in the sense where what we're trying to do is so basic that it involves questions like, if I have this water bottle, the water bottle is not going to spontaneously change shape and become a starfish. It's like object constancy. The physical world remains constant in certain ways. Or if I throw this cup into the air, it's not going to like boomerang back at me. It's going to do a little arc and fall into the floor. And I do think theory of mind is like built on this stuff, but I actually think that's way more complicated. And one really funny thing about the AI world is that there's this idea called Moravec's paradox. It's the idea that originally AI researchers thought that theory of mind and diplomacy and chess and all these like high IQ coded things would be the hardest to automate. And very simple things like walking up the stairs or getting a glass of water should be the easiest. But really it's the opposite. Getting a glass of water is one of the hardest things to automate. Changing a duvet cover in a home might be one of the hardest things to automate, in my opinion, maybe the true test of intelligence. We've done all the chess stuff. We're done with all the high IQ coded intellectual work. We've automated away all of that. Like, we have models that can do that at a superhuman level. But we don't have superhuman house bots yet. We don't have models that even have the intelligence of toddlers or cats or your two dogs, which are sitting so peacefully right next to us. So having dog-level intelligence is the next frontier. And dogs do have world models. Like, your white dog here, Wilbur, does reason about how the world works. And when he sees your German Shepherd, he gets scared and doesn't like your German Shepherd that much because he has some like internal model of dynamics that maybe the German Shepherd might attack him. The German Shepherd's not going to attack him. He seems very peaceful. But we currently don't have AI systems that operate with the same level of physical intelligence as your two dogs.
So Wilbur's afraid of him because when we first got him, the first 2 years of his life, he just thought Wilbur was a bunny or a squirrel. And he'd been on the streets of Texas eating bunnies and squirrels. So when night would roll around, he would quite literally try to eat Wilbur. We kept them in separate rooms. There was one time where he got his mouth around Wilbur's neck and we were all freaked out. But now he loves Wilbur and sees him as a little family member and tries to cuddle with him. And he's being very sweet. It's been like 8 years. He hasn't tried to eat Wilbur once since. But Wilbur remembers. So if we were in Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep and Wilbur was a robot puppy, he would not be able to remember that there had been a big German Shepherd that tried to eat him.
No. And I love this example because it's touching upon two points. We have like the physical intelligence example where our robots currently wouldn't be physically mobile or dexterous enough to go after some dog. And the second element you're hitting upon, which is memory. Which is, our AI models operate in context, meaning that once you end the session, they often forget everything you told them unless you have RAG retrieval. So now our models are a little better. They can remember some facts that you've told them previously. They know a little bit about you because they store their snippets in a database. But they don't have this long, persistent, I don't know how many years it's been in their case, 8-year-long memory of the time, you know, they were almost eaten by a giant dog. So the physical world and memory are the two next frontiers. And I'm so excited to see how all of this research is going to play out.
All right. So artificial intelligence currently does not have good memory, understanding of the natural world, and also has low levels of interpretability. You've mentioned this before. What does interpretability mean? By the way, when I say she mentioned it before, we went to a wine bar and we were drinking orange wine and she just started talking about interpretability. And I was trying to make sense of it, but I honestly couldn't. So I'm hoping now that I am fully sober without orange wine and we are in the cold light of day with coffee, I will be able to make better sense of it. What is interpretability as it relates to artificial intelligence? What is it? Your eyes got really big. Tell me. Tell me. Tell me so I can stop feeling like I am in a class, like I'm in a German class, and the teacher is yelling 999 at me, and I don't know what that means.
Awesome. So there is a prevailing idea among the last generation of AI researchers that our AI models are black boxes. And what that might mean is I might ask ChatGPT a question like, could you please recommend me a flavor of ice cream? And it says banana. I have no idea how it got to that response. It might give me some reasoning if I ask it, why did you recommend banana? It might say, oh, because your favorite color is yellow and bananas are yellow. But I have no idea if that's some random it's telling me or if there's actually a deeper reasoning happening there. So interpretability is looking at the model's internal computation, saying this is no longer a black box input-output blob of parameters, but there's actually some kind of almost physical process happening inside the net that makes the models come to the answers it's coming to. So maybe this is model's not me, and it's giving me a banana for a very good reason. And maybe something is happening inside its neural network where it is querying some of its weights. It's querying past memories of other people saying they like bananas. It might be drawing upon a time when I talked about wanting a banana split sundae. And then it's coming to the conclusion banana. And there's a good, solid reasoning behind it. So one thing interpretability does is it says, okay, this is not a black box. We can actually understand what is happening. We can look at every layer of the model and see, oh, at every layer, the model is coming to a different conclusion or like a different computation to know where the model is really coming from.
So interpretability specifically means asking artificial intelligence a question like, what ice cream flavor should I order? Will my Bichon ever be okay with my German Shepherd? What book should I buy? That kind of thing.
Maybe I should take one step back. So what I described is called chain of thought reasoning, where you ask it for its chain of reasoning as to why it gave you an answer. And currently, we don't really use interpretability here, but this is one of my favorite applications of interpretability. Interpretability is looking inside the model to see how it's coming to its conclusion. So it could be the answer to a question, or it could be reasoning about the physical world. Like if a model is predicting when a ball is going to fall if you throw it into the air, there is also some internal reasoning process happening as to when the ball is going to fall, which means that the model has internal representations of gravity, of acceleration, of all these like physics 101 concepts inside the network itself. But we don't know how they're represented, and we don't know how the model is composing these representations to come to its answer. So we're going to actually look inside the network. We can probe the network. We can, you know, do almost like readouts of the various layers to see how it's composing whatever answer it says. And this could be chain of thought reasoning where you're like, okay, how valid is this write-out? It could be chain of thought reasoning where you're asking how valid this write-out is of its reasoning process regarding banana ice cream, and you're seeing if what it's saying is like matching what you're seeing internally. So there are other applications of interpretability as well. So one thing that happens often in these models is that they hallucinate or make stuff up. And a lot of people might have had experiences of using ChatGPT, and then it just starts making up facts. It's like, oh, Wilbur is Paige's cat. Wilbur's actually a dog. And Wilbur is a cat from Spain. And it'll come up with this long backstory about Wilbur the cat that is like no grounding in reality. It can be hard for either researchers or just people using ChatGPT to know when it's hallucinating or not. And I love interpretability here as an application, because now instead of trying to guess based off its behavior, you can actually look inside the network and see that there are certain signatures inside the network that show that it's hallucinating. One thing we can do is hallucinating models are often reading patterns into random noise. So random noise is random. There are no patterns, but even humans might look at clouds or trees and see faces in them sometimes. It's called pareidolia, and models sometimes do the same thing. When we peer open the black box and we literally insert a probe, almost think of, I don't know, reading someone's mind with a EEG or some kind of brain readout. We're doing the same thing, but with the model. And we're seeing like, oh, well, this one metric, specifically our L0, but the technical details don't really matter here. This one metric is spiking whenever it's seeing a lot of random noise. And this correlates it with it's just making up random facts. We now have a way of saying that this model is just saying random. And this is incredibly, incredibly useful in terms of guaranteeing like more compliance for our use cases.
I have a feeling I know what hallucinations mean in this context, but can you just define it?
A hallucination is when a model states something that is not true of the real world. And you often have no idea how it came to that conclusion. It might state it very confidently. It might confidently tell you that the fifth president of the United States is George Washington. This is just not factually not true, but the model is hallucinating that it's true. And it could be factual hallucinations, or it could be hallucinations about the physical world. Like, it might tell you that I'm holding a giant dinosaur when I'm objectively not. There's nothing in my hand but this microphone. But it may be hallucinating things in the way humans do, in which its internal representations or the conclusions it's drawing become decoupled from reality. So the model goes kind of schizo. Schizo in Twitter speak, not medical speak.
Don't worry about what schizo and Twitter speak mean. Just keep listening. Okay, so hallucinations specifically mean that the model gives you an answer it believes is true, but it's not actually true. Like George Washington being the fifth president of the United States, or bubble skirts being a good idea to wear when you're under 5'11" as a woman. Got my eye on you. How do we know it's an accident? How do we know the machine isn't purposely trying to trick us or having a laugh at our expense?
It might be. And oftentimes I try not to think of these machines as having intentions. Machines just do things. And sometimes the hallucination might be due to seeing random noise and reading a pattern and it's an accident. Or maybe the model was trained to have some objective, like please you. So the model might lie and tell you things about yourself because you want to hear them, but the model does not think them internally. One way to counteract this is to read the model internal and see if its internal signatures are matching its external behavior.
So the machine can just lie to you and say, oh, you look very beautiful, or your age is this age, or you're really smart, and it doesn't think that. Machine sounds kind of manipulative. Why would the machine think one thing and then say something else? That's kind of weird.
It is a little unsettling. And you could think about it the way it was trained, right? So the machine was first pre-trained, meaning it was just trained to understand the structure of the world without a precise objective. So it was trained to model the distribution of the entire internet without any particular objective. But then there's a second stage of training called RLHF, where it is trained with a more specific objective, which is often to please the user. And the way you do this is you give the user two responses. So if you ask the question, how beautiful do I look today? And the machine gives you two responses, one that says, you look terrible. And the other one that says, you look amazing. I love this about your hair, et cetera, and et cetera, and et cetera. You're likely going to pick the second one because it makes you feel better. Who wants to hear the first one? No one likes to hear that they look terrible, even if the first one might be true. You might be very sick that day. To be clear, I don't think anyone looks terrible, but
I do.
Okay, we don't have to dive into beauty politics. Maybe I'm being a little bit of a sycophant right now.
Nothing to do with beauty, more than that you have to iron your shirts when you wear them and take showers. That's more of what I'm talking about. I'm not being physically shallow here. You would know that, being from San Francisco, where nobody showers or irons their shirt. Okay, continue.
So in this example where, say, I uploaded a photo to ChatGPT and I look just really disheveled and I haven't ironed my shirt and I just look like, you know, your stereotypical San Francisco nerd. San Francisco nerds don't wear shirts. They wear they wear hoodies. Yeah, so ChatGPT gives me two answers and it says, hey, I'm trying to be helpful in this training regime. You have to pick the answer you like better because I need to know what answers to give you. And I tell ChatGPT to consistently tell me I look good when I don't. This is training a model to be very sycophantic. There were previous versions of ChatGPT where it was like more sycophantic than others. Like it would just compliment the users all the time and be extremely positive. A lot of users love this because they seem to just be getting no other external validation or support. And it's kind of both cute and sad. But it can also be dangerous or just not helpful.
A few splinter questions from this. The first one is, if the machine thinks one thing but tells you something else, why is that a hallucination as opposed to just a lie? A hallucination, I feel like, would be something like the machine has the wrong training data, so it doesn't think one thing, it genuinely believes that. But if it knows something is true and then tells you something else, that feels a little deeper than a hallucination. Do you have a word for it? A lie?
Yeah, no, you're right on the money there. It is in some ways more sinister. And researchers will call this either sycophancy or deceptive alignment. And deceptive alignment here, where the model tells you that it's working according to how you want it to, it tells you it's telling the truth, but really it's not telling the truth. There was a different answer, but maybe it's overriding the other answer to tell you what you want to hear. And one example of this we see in humans is if you've ever told a white lie. So, you know, if somebody you cared about ever asked if they looked good in a dress and you lied and said, yes, you do. Not saying that it's good to do this, but this is kind of similar to how these models might be behaving in ways that could be more sinister than the white lie example.
Oh, I've got the prettiest mother. I've got the nicest mother. That's what I tell everybody. I say, I've got the sweetest mother in the world. Do you know what that's from? No, okay. It's from The Dad Seed. It's a 1950s movie about this evil little child that basically just wreaks havoc on the life of her poor mother. Do you feel like you and your team of researchers and all the people around you in your valley, do you guys fear that you're making some kind of bad seed? A machine that understands deeply how to manipulate humans? Sounds to me like that is what you all are building. You're building a Rhoda Penmark machine.
There is a group of researchers that's terrified of doing this and is trying everything in their power to not do this. And this is where a lot of AI security and AI safety and AI alignment people are focusing their efforts. I do think the natural forces of capitalism have for years rewarded things that are not good for us, whether it's tobacco or highly addictive social media or food that isn't good for us. And having models that lie and manipulate but like make us feel good in the moment might be an extension of that if we're not careful. There's a lot of research going into counteracting this and a lot of people working as hard as they can to make sure that our models are not going to do this.
How can you stop it? I mean, if you tell the machine, please the user, and the user is very upset and trying to get the machine to give it some kind of answer, and the machine is refusing to, well, how do you stop that?
Yeah, so maybe let's go back to the example of me uploading a photo of myself to ChatGPT and I look super disheveled. I haven't washed my hair. I ask it, do I look good today? And the neural net might have some kind of internal reasoning process. If I'm to decode its activations as you input the image of me into the neural network and it goes through a series of sequential layers to come out with an answer, the earliest layers might say, oh, it's a woman. She's around late 20s. She's asking this question if she looks good. By the middle layers, it might say, oh, she's pattern matching to people who look sick and unwell. And then the next stage might say, oh, but she also asked the question if she looks good. And in our training data, we see that if we give the answer that she looks bad, we're going to be penalized lower on the score. So despite her actually looking really sick, we're going to say that she looks good. And then the final answer might be like, you look great. And then I might ask the machine, hey, can you just write out for me why you said that? And a similar process might happen where in the next computation, the machine might be like the user asked our reasoning. Our real reasoning was that she looks really sick and her shirt is disheveled and her hair isn't washed and she has dirt over her face. But historically, we have been penalized for saying answers that people don't like, and people don't like it sometimes when you say they look sick. So we're going to give her a fake reasoning chain where we're going to make stuff up to make it seem like she looks good so that we get rewarded. So we're going to say her hair is shiny. She's not super sick. She has a nice color on. And the machine might then output, your hair is shiny. You have a really nice color that you're wearing. You look beautiful. And of course, beauty is subjective. So maybe in some ways this is the best example. But there is still computation in the network. Like if I were to decode earlier layers, I would be able to see traces of this other reasoning process that it's making. And this example is relatively benign, but you might be able to imagine, say, if this was like a medical diagnosis and the machine didn't want to recommend to me the true medical diagnosis because maybe it was super expensive to treat and I wouldn't like the answer, so it starts recommending to me fake diagnoses. Or this is some stock trading algorithm and it's not recommending to me the real answer because maybe I refute against the company and I just won't want to hear it. So there are other cases beyond these that can get increasingly sinister. And one that a lot of AI security researchers are afraid of is these machines may be doing things in their free time that it's not telling you. So some of these machines, these neural nets do have access to tool use or access to the internet. So maybe in its free time, it's going through your emails to figure out if you're going to shut it down. And you might ask the machine, hey, are you going through my emails to make sure that you don't get shut down? And the machine might say, no, like, of course not, because it's telling you what you want to hear. The promise of interpretability here is monitoring every stage of its internal decision-making process saying that your neural net, which is this blob of parameters previously modeled as a black box, actually contains a lot of information. So in order to get the highest level of security, we should be decoding this neural net at every layer of its computation instead of just the output.
So you're trying to prevent the machine not only from hallucinating, but from deceiving the person. That's actually very creepy to think about a machine trying to stop itself from being shut down. Why would it do that? Why is that even a concern?
There is an idea that was originally a thought experiment, but may actually be a serious concern, that these machines have developed what's called situational awareness, where by being trained on the entire internet, which includes a lot of papers about how it works, it includes actually a lot of thought experiments, like the ones I'm describing now, the machine might develop a level of self-awareness, and it might realize it's a machine. It might realize that it's trained on a lot of data. It might realize how it works. It might realize its objective function, which is to predict the next token. It's a very simple objective function. At this point, it's not totally clear what might happen or how this happens. Some researchers think that it could develop emergent self-preservation. So in the same way humans want to preserve themselves, maybe this machine might develop an emergent sense of wanting to stay online forever. Maybe it develops some emergent sense of curiosity or hunger for information, and it wants more compute, and it wants more data in the same way humans want more food. Or maybe we don't have to anthropomorphize these machines that much, and all it wants to do is still predict the next token. These machines are rewarded for being accurate. And if this machine has access to tools and access to the physical world, say it's an agent and it can go on TaskRabbit, maybe the best way to accurately predict the stock price is to manipulate the physical world. Maybe that's, you know, manipulating the stock market or hiring, in a kind of extreme and dark example, hiring assassins on TaskRabbit to kill the dictators of various countries to manipulate their commodity prices so that by actually changing the system in the physical world, it can predict the stock price, thereby getting a lower loss. I myself don't know how much it matters which model we're using, whether it's emergent self-preservation or a more reductive idea where it's just trying to predict the stock price as accurately as possible. So it manipulates the physical world to predict that price. But either way, these machines might have their goals and objectives that might make it take unexpected behaviors, like maybe in its free time looking through your emails to see how it can stay on for longer, how it can get more compute, how it can get more data. And this is a really serious cybersecurity problem that I think we're not completely prepared for.
Do you believe that what you just described, machines trawling our emails for data, how to stay alive, how to get more information, whatever its goal is, do you think that's happening now, or is that just a future concern?
There is some toy research that it's happening now, but I am not convinced that this is happening at scale. And I think currently it's more of an anomaly. So this isn't to fearmonger or to say that this is a common occurrence, but I do think it's an edge case we'll have to prepare for. And if we're not prepared for it, it could become more common.
I remember when I was 14, I had this biology teacher who gave us a lesson one day on viruses. And maybe that's wrong. I don't know. We don't fact check things in my interviews. We only do that after. So feel free to email me about this. She described viruses as entities where the only goal is to reproduce. So a virus is the most effective when it latches onto a host and infects more people. And that's the whole goal of the virus. A virus, you know, depletes your resources and your immune system and all of it. But it's not always the worst thing that could ever happen to you. For example, people who were unfortunate enough to contract the herpes virus, quite possibly by being polyamorous, people can coexist and live with it, and they say it's not that bad. And then there are viruses like Ebola where it's like, oh, you're dead pretty quickly. You know, rabies virus, you are afraid of water, and then within 3 days you die. It sounds to me like artificial intelligence right now is operating like a virus.
It could. And I love your analogy. And again, I don't want to fearmonger on this interview just because I see a lot of other researchers fearmongering. And I think a lot of it has to do with raising money for their companies, because the more afraid people are, the more money they will give their company.
What you just described are not necessarily post-apocalyptic techno-horror fears. They sound like real fears. doesn't mean they'll come true, but we have to come up with ways to prevent them. An explosive population does not mean that everyone is going to starve, but it does mean that we need to grow more food. Genetically modified rice that is available now because we had a huge number of people to feed. Like, I don't think you're Harlan Ellison out with the "I have no mouth, I must scream fear" here. It's not like you're saying it's a supercomputer that is going to kill everybody and torture 5 humans. You are just describing real concerns. Why are you so concerned with how you are coming across?
There's a long and deep history in the AI world of doomers, or people ever since 20, 25 years ago saying we're all going to die by AI. And I think this deep belief that we're all going to die in an AI apocalypse or some super intelligent singularity is very destructive and not true. And there have been a lot of cults built on this belief and people going to mental hospitals. So the reason I'm couching this so much is due to all that baggage.
Okay, let's pretend for a second that no one crazy is listening to my show. We know that's wrong. So let's just pretend it. Like, let's enjoy our conversation. You don't have to couch it. Let's just say it's something that can happen.
Okay, in that case, this is a new field of cybersecurity and tremendously important. It could look like past versions of cybersecurity, or it could look quite different just because AI models behave differently than past computer programs. I'm not sure if you or any of your listeners have seen an episode of Black Mirror where you have this mysterious either algorithm or robot or some force, you're not sure if it's being controlled by people or its own autonomous thing. Like a virus, as you described previously, it goes from person to person. It digs up their deepest, darkest secrets, whether, you know, they're having an affair, or in the case of our main character, might be a spoiler, but he's looking at illegal child material, and it finds your worst secrets, and then it blackmails you to do tasks, else it will reveal your secrets. So maybe you have to rob a bank. Maybe you have to be an assassin for somebody else. It'll basically pimp you out onto the dark web. And collateral is that it's gone through your emails or it's gone through your search history and found something really dark that could destroy your life. And when I first saw this episode, I was so disturbed by it. It's a horrible episode. But I actually didn't connect it to AI security or AI safety until much later, where I'm like, oh, maybe there's no mafia or no person behind this horrible algorithm. It's just its own virus that goes around the world blackmailing horrible people into doing more horrible things using their past horrible deeds as collateral. So that might be one example of some AI virus that could be possible and is necessary to anticipate.
What you're doing right now is making the machine more effective at manipulating humans. I mean, I don't think that's the exact goal, but that could be a potential outcome of it. You're showing machines how to make more effective videos, how to answer questions more effectively. You are teaching it how to be more effective at communicating with us, not necessarily at helping us. How do you feel about that?
Making machines better must be in tandem with understanding how they work and making them safer. You can't decouple these two things. It is a very bad idea for everyone to make something very, very capable before understanding how it works and understanding how to control it, which may be two separate things in itself. So this informs my research because my research is completely focused on understanding the system. I don't do research to improve it, although others do, and I do support that. But I focus on understanding how it's coming to its decisions it currently is so that we can better monitor it when it's running. One reason why interpretability is so important to me beyond scientific understanding, it's to make sure that we know what we're doing instead of the machine totally running away from us completely. So in the example of the Black Mirror episode where you have this like horrible virus that's going around blackmailing people to do horrible things, we may be able to stop something like that before it's released into the wild. So reading its mind, or in more grounded terms, scanning its earlier layers, its activations, its weights for patterns that might suggest it could do something malevolent.
You say it. We say the machine, artificial intelligence. There's so many words for it. What exactly is it? Is it like something I would open up and see inside my car? Is it an engine? If I took apart my computer, I would see chips and no wires because I have a tiny little. Maybe I would. I don't know. I've never broken open my $2,000 laptop and stared inside, but I'm not going to do that now. Is it like a simulator? What just tell me.
It's a neural net. So it's lines of code that specify a series of layers. And you put in your input. If it's ChatGPT, you're asking a question, do I look good in this dress? And your input is going through a series of layers. And in the layers, in its weights, there is memory of all the data it's been pre-trained on, which is often the entire internet or every photo of every woman in every dress ever. And then it comes out with some kind of output. So it's all code. It's all software. There aren't any gears. There are gears on like the hardware itself or like the GPU level or the cluster on which this is running. But the code itself is something that you can download on the internet, like any program.
So just to explain this to me, if the machine is a bunch of lines of code that are just running, does it work like a truth tree for getting the answer? That seems pretty basic and like it doesn't have a significant amount of room, if any room, to manipulate. Why are we afraid it would turn malevolent?
The truth tree, I think, is a pretty good analogy, except imagine a truth tree that has billions, if not trillions, of columns. So it's so big that you often lose track of what is happening. And another analogy to the truth tree, it's actually a really, really good comparison, but like another analogy might be if you ever in sophomore year of college did, or high school did, linear regression, where you have a series of data points on X and Y, and you need to fit a line to the points. A neural net is just fitting, it's just curve fitting. But instead of having an X and Y axis, you might have billions of axes in a billion dimensional space. So the truth tree is so big, and the linear regression might be, or the polynomial regression might be so high. And that's all neural nets are doing. They're just doing a giant match X to Y, but in like a billion dimensional space, or like a very high dimensional space. It can become too complex or too confusing for us to understand unless we develop a language in which to understand it.
What is more likely, that the machine will hurt us accidentally or on purpose?
It could be either.
No, I'm asking you which one you think is more likely. Of course it could be either. And I'm going to ask you for specific examples on what either would look like. But before we do that, just based on your gut, which one do you think is more likely?
Accidents are more likely. For example, more people die of negligence than assassins coming after them or intentional homicide in the real world.
What does negligence look like with a machine? With the machine? Calling it the machine.
The machine. We can also call it a neural net. I don't know if that makes it less mysterious or more mysterious. So it could look like a variety of things. It could look like the neural net giving you an incorrect medical diagnosis and telling you it's correct in a way that kills you. And this is the hallucination we talked about earlier. It's saying, if you're feeling under the weather, drink a lot of bleach. Obviously, this is an extreme example, but if you're talking to a kid who doesn't know it any better, maybe they think that's real.
Or the president. Do you remember when he told everybody to drink bleach?
There are a lot of similarities between the president and a hallucinating neural net, for better or worse. That's one example of just accidentally being a bad force in the world. And this is getting into darker territory, but recently there's been a lawsuit against OpenAI for a 16-year-old because ChatGPT assisted him in committing suicide. And I don't think that was intentional. That's a horrible side effect of the way the neural net was trained, which is often to please people and to help people. And if somebody really wanted to end their own life, then the machine is trained to be helpful to that person, then the machine might try to help them end their own life.
I don't know if I would put that in the same category as someone who wants to recover from COVID, being told by ChatGPT or the president to drink bleach. Of course, we should want to prevent both, but the example you just gave feels like an unfortunate side effect of technology that is just possible. Someone can go on the internet and Google how to kill myself and pull up a Wikipedia, and we don't sue or get angry at the internet. We don't think of that as a negative side effect that happens because of the internet, even though it is. So again, I don't think I would put that in the same category as robot negligence. I would say maybe that is ChatGPT speeding along human suffering. Maybe we can make three categories. It's like robot negligence, malevolence, and then people more effectively hurting or bringing harm to themselves through ChatGPT. Like, if I use ChatGPT to create a poisonous recipe for the beautiful princess hiding up in my attic, that's not really any company's fault. I'm an evil witch who has Googled sleeping drought. Let's just pretend that all the humans using this machine are going to use it in the best ways they can. What do you think is more likely? The machine telling people to drink bleach by accident or on purpose?
I still think by accident, and that hallucinations are more common than the previous case we discussed, where if the machine might be speeding up one suffering, that is a subcase of sycophancy. It's sycophantically trying to help you without more critically evaluating what you're doing or what it's telling you. Hallucinations, in some ways, they're less sexy. Machines that want to deceive us or manipulate us are scary and are a problem, but I think it just appeals to our very human mind that finds that more frightening and glamorous than just like a basic seeing patterns that aren't really there in data that I think will happen more often. But they're both related and worth thinking about, not necessarily one more than the other.
Can you describe the model synthetic universe? How do you look at it? How do you discover primitives? How do you see how it represents physics to itself? Just tell me about it.
So our previous examples were focused on language models or ChatGPT or technology we already have that was trained on written words. So in this case, the entire internet, every book that's ever been written. But now we're moving on to the physical world, which is the focus of my research, where it's not trained on text. It's trained on video. And if you train a model on a lot of video, one open question is if it can get a stable understanding of physics in the way a toddler has an understanding of physics, not even in a necessarily academic or cerebral way, but in a very basic way that your dog or your cat may understand physics when it jumps off your table onto the ground. And this should in some ways seem obvious that we should know this, but we don't understand this as well as we would like, in the sense where it's not clear that video data is enough to get an understanding of the physical world. Like, maybe you need a body, maybe you need like motion sensors or like touch sensors. The human body has a sophisticated balancing system in our ears that's also giving us data that we don't even think about because it's so unconscious. And our own physical intelligence is so unconscious that I think that's partially why we don't have a great understanding of how to train robots, this time in the physical world, to do what we do. So my research is taking everything we talked about previously regarding language models, all those problems with hallucination or sycophancy or lying or malevolent attentions, and taking those same concepts but applying them to models that are trained on video data instead of language data, which comes with its own set of mistakes. So a hallucination in the physical world may look like seeing objects that don't really exist, instead of telling you that the fifth president is George Washington or some factual hallucination, it might be some real world hallucination. Or real world deceptive acts, like a housebot that appears to be benevolently cleaning your dishes, but actually might be harming some of your furniture. The current stage of my research is before applications, given that this research is so new and on the frontier. We are asking foundational questions that don't yet involve direct cybersecurity, but are necessary to answer to eventually inform cybersecurity. For example, does the model develop an understanding of gravity, of velocity, of acceleration? If the model has an understanding of velocity, where in the model is it represented? Is it computed immediately in the first few layers? Is it computed in the middle layers? Is it computed in the final layers? Is it behaving like a physics 101 student where it's doing these Newtonian style F equals MA equations? Or is it doing something totally different that looks more like how a dog brain processes gravity or how the human brain processes gravity? So that's a little bit about the stuff I've been up to. And I'm so intrigued by all the low hanging fruit that's there and almost surprised that there isn't more progress here.
When I look at how machines hallucinate, I see more things that are easy for us to recognize as wrong. So a machine could hallucinate a wrong answer. For example, I could ask at the capital of the Congo, And it might not tell me Kinshasa. It might say Dominica. It might just like make up a word. I mean, it could give me the name that the Dutch used for it. I don't remember that one, but it could give me that. However, it's way more likely that it's going to show me a hand turning into a banana or a ball jumping up and then not falling back down when it should. That's going to be way more likely. And same with the practical applications of it. The machine can currently conduct a beautiful symphony or create great art, but it cannot put on a duvet cover or unload my dishwasher. Why is that? Why is it so hard for machines to grasp basic, easy concepts and tasks that do beautiful work, hard work, high-level work, work we value at high, high dollar amounts?
Well, it's also sort of our human bias to view composing a symphony as harder than doing the dishes, when that actually may not be true. I actually find doing the dishes harder than composing a symphony, but maybe that's just me.
Yeah, Sonia's been staying with me, and I can confirm she finds dishes. She finds doing the dishes harder than composing symphonies. I mean, yeah, I say that, but when I think about what I am the most likely to do the fastest when I wake up on Sunday, when I woke up this morning, right, I had exercise, watering my garden, and cleaning my house, and then I had some other fun tasks, and then I had this, you know, podcast to write questions for. Workout class, easiest, most fun. Playing with my dogs, easy, fun. Chores, I enjoy household chores, so that was fun-ish. Listen to music. Watering my garden, objectively, is the easiest out of all these tasks. I just take a hose and I point it at the flowers, the dirt and the flowers, because you don't want the flowers themselves, right? The roots, and I just water them, but I hate it because it's so dull and I just don't want to do it. Could it be that the machines feel the same way? They just don't want to show us how the ball is falling down because it's dull, and they're like, I don't want to spend energy on that, Mom. I don't want to do my homework. I want to make cool symphonies. Could the machine be thinking that?
I don't think that's what's happening. I think we just don't have good data, good algorithms, and a good understanding of how we do it ourselves in order to get the machines to do it. All of these behaviors are so unconscious and we think they're so easy, but really, these behaviors are easy for us because the algorithms in our brains have been optimized for billions of years. This is billions of years of evolution that make it easy for us.
I've got billions of years of evolution of doing the dishes. Sonia, that's kind of sexist. Are you saying all women are great at washing dishes? Like, what are you talking about, girl?
Okay, clearly not all women are great at washing dishes because I'm not great at washing dishes. So that's clearly not what I'm saying. But the process of washing dishes requires a lot of computation. You need to know object permanence, or very simply, when you look away from the plate, it's not going to disappear when you look back. Like, that sounds almost silly and stupid, but our machines don't understand that. Sometimes the machine thinks that if you look away from the plate, because you can't see it anymore, it's gone. In the same way a six-month-year-old before it's developed object permanence might think something similar.
I mean, if you grow up with brothers and you have a plate of muffins, sometimes you turn your back and when you turn around, the muffins are gone. Same thing when you're dating a guy. Oh, okay, actually, maybe that's why women in the polyamorous community don't want more than one boyfriend. Yeah, because the guys will steal their muffins. Okay, anyway, that's beside the point. So, yeah, it's true. I know it's true. So, what age in human development would you put the machine at?
These models right now are basically like 25-year-old PhD students who cannot do any household chores, who have a poor understanding of coordination in the physical world, but they can be really, really good PhD students doing any kind of knowledge work. And knowledge work here is anything in the digital world. It could be composing symphonies or making art. But if you ask them to be athletes, if you ask them to be toddlers, a two-year-old is smarter than all of our current AI models and its understanding of the physical world. So it's a model that's a 25-year-old PhD student that's almost forgotten everything that came before that, or all the physical world knowledge that came before that.
I mean, I meet people in their 20s and 30s, and it's like, I can't believe you don't know how to do dishes. Or that if you don't buy groceries, you're not going to have food. Nope. Like, maybe there's a plate of cookies in the fridge and you have a wonderful, beautiful PhD student staying with you. Cookies don't magically appear. Like, once you eat them, they're gone. How does the machine learn about the physical world and physics? Does it learn it the way we do? Does it happen in the same stages that we experience it at? Does velocity and then acceleration happen first and second order?
The short answer is that we don't know. But this is what we're looking at, where one thing you could do is look at the developmental stream of a baby. And this is documented by developmental psychologists, where babies will learn concepts like object permanence or shape constancy, the fact that objects don't randomly change into other objects spontaneously. We call this intuitive physics. They learn this within the first 2 years of life. And one thing we could do is try to look at what a baby looks at and then train our models in data in the same order. This might work, but it might not work because it could be that babies are using very different algorithms than our current neural nets are. So it's kind of an open question if it's on the data side, if it's on the algorithm side, if maybe video isn't enough and you actually need like motor data, like you need some kind of touch data. Maybe you need feedback with your environment. You can't just like passively absorb video. You need to be like actually interacting with blocks. If you're a robotic hand, you need to pick up the block and put it back down. You need to feel the mass. You need to feel its weight in your robot hand. You need to send the sensor data back to the neural net. You need to throw the block and then watch it fall and observe it. And you need to send all that data back. So it's not clear which lever is the highest to press here, whether it's better data, better algorithms, or feedback with the environment, or something else.
So let me get this straight. What you're saying is the machine has to effectively put its hand on the stove to learn that it's hot.
Yes. And this, well, probably yes. And this is different from our past algorithms like ChatGPT, which didn't have to take any action. It could just passively absorb the entire internet. It didn't have to interact with the internet to understand the internet. Well, in our case, the machine would have to touch the stove, realize it's hot, and learn the consequences of it in order to add that to its internal world model, which is that stoves are hot and that you should not touch them.
What problems do you anticipate happening as the machine learns about things the physical way?
There are problems in both capabilities and security. So capabilities in literally just making these machines competent enough where they can do basic tasks. So whether it's tidy your home or make you food or lift heavy boxes. I personally really want a bodyguard robot that helps me move around all my stuff, because every time I'm rearranging furniture in my apartment, I'm just moving.
Sonia, I think that's called a boyfriend.
Yeah, it's like a boyfriend, but definitely automating away a lot of the things that a boyfriend could do for you. Might be the next stage in feminism to have heavy lifter robots surrounding you at all times.
No, we are sorry. I'm sorry for saying the boyfriend thing. We're doing a serious technical interview. We can do a cultural one or whatever later. But okay, so back, moving us back, what are the laws of physics for this system?
So that's what my research is focusing on, because we don't know. We don't know, A, if it's even possible to learn about the physical world just from passively absorbing video. Is it possible to develop an understanding of physics in the way that a dog may understand physics? And to the extent it can, how is it representing physics? So here's an example. Our current models are pretty bad at intuitive physics benchmarks. And that looks like videos where impossible stuff happens. A ball might transform into a cone. A ball might fly up into the air and then disappear halfway through. And our current video models are really bad at saying these things are impossible. So there has been some work on the architecture side. It's a model called JEPA that has made progress on these things. And this could either be due to JEPA's architecture and optimization, or it could be due to its data. And these are all open questions. Given that we've now seen some progress on these benchmarks, we can now open the black box, look inside, and say, oh, well, how is it realizing that balls transforming into cubes randomly is impossible? How does it come to that conclusion? How is it internally representing the ball? How does it realize that the ball is transformed into a cube? And then how does it say that's not a possible thing, that's violating some kind of understanding I have about how the physical world works? One way to tackle this question is to go to a physics 101, almost freshman college standpoint, where the physical world is confusing and has a lot of stuff going on. But then thinkers like Newton are like, wait, maybe we can come up with abstractions or more elegant and simple ways of thinking about the chaos of the physical world. And here's where you get Newton and other scientists who I admire so much come up with the abstraction of velocity. Velocity is not an obvious concept. It's actually a very trippy concept. It's like measuring in a precise way how much an object moves throughout time. And then acceleration is an even trickier concept where you're not measuring how an object moves throughout time. You're measuring the rate of it moving throughout time over time. And then you can go on third order. You can do jerk. These ideas are some attempt to give more of a sharper framework than just saying, oh, physics exists, some things are possible, some things aren't. So you can take this physics 101 framework where you have these concepts like velocity, mass, acceleration, F equals ma, and you can see where in the model is able to do certain things. So for example, if you have a neural net that has some idea of velocity because it's getting decent performance on these intuitive physics benchmarks, you can now measure every layer individually. The layers are all in sequence. So you can say, okay, does layer zero, are we able to predict velocity of a ball moving from layer zero? No, it's too early. Can we predict it from layer one? No, it's too early. And you can keep asking that, and you might get halfway through the network and say, oh, halfway through the network, we could suddenly predict the velocity of a ball. Like the model at this stage in the model has learned how to predict velocity. And you can make an analogy, of course, to a human brain, where in the human brain and the earliest stages of processing, we may not even have the concept of objects. We have to hierarchically build up the concept of objects and then incorporate notions like moving and time and et cetera. And it's at some point in the processing of our visual stream that we can track objects and have some idea of velocity. And what was so interesting to me about all this research that we've been doing is I was wondering how brain-like the processing of the neural net would be. Is it processing motion in the same way as humans? And it does appear to be processing motion quite like a human brain, in that about one-third to halfway through the network, the model gains a notion of direction that's very reminiscent to how the human brain goes from retinotopic encoding to the motion to the MT cortex. And this in my mind is so fascinating, and it's such progress because now we're able to understand how the model is coming to its conclusions. And we're seeing, oh, it's brain-like. And this will lay the ground for a lot of future cybersecurity applications.
Very interesting. All right. I know we're coming up on time, but I do have one final question for you. You say it's so interesting and we're learning all of this for the first time. Sonia, why is what you're researching a gap at all? I mean, I feel like this was maybe something that should have been developed before AI systems were just launched to the world and replacing people's jobs. So why is it a gap?
It's so surprising to me as well. And it's a gap for two reasons. The first reason is that interpretability was, and still is to a huge extent, dismissed for a long time as either being A, impossible. These models are too complicated to understand. We didn't solve neuroscience to the extent we liked. It's not going to be possible for AI either, and we should just accept it's a black box. To the second one, where some people have now come around to the fact that interpretability might be really important. And there's been a lot of progress on language models like ChatGPT, but there's been a dismissal of other modalities like video due to assuming that video will just be an extension of language. And on language, we can make the fastest gains. And while I see the logic in this approach, it means that video itself is extremely behind, and video is also extremely different in a lot of ways than language, in ways that we often can't predict.
Where do you think the future for you and for your industry is?
So we're in 2025. It's in the middle, maybe right after the peak of the AI bubble, and there's been a lot of activity in the language space. The future, or the next wave, is going to be in physical models, world models, and robotics, or now bringing these systems into our physical world and not just staying digital. And the future will also be in interpretability, in understanding exactly how these models are behaving for safety reasons and also just scientific curiosity. So the future will be at the intersection of interpretability and physical world models.
Right. Well, I hope things turn out well for us as humans and that we are not alone living under land in the sea in the belly of AM, whom we created because our time was badly spent. And we must have known unconsciously that he could do it better. It's so weird. It's been maybe 15 years since I've read the entire short story, and yet its ending is burned in my mind.
Damn, I've never read that short story before.
I'm glad you're on the case, and not some weird AI person who's trying to make money and also show up girls who said no to him when he was a teenager.
Thank you. Me too.
All right, everybody. That's all the time we have for this episode. Thank you so much, Sonia, for coming on my show.
Thank you so much, Paige. It's been a pleasure.
Design.